Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Peter DeShazo. I'm the director of the Americas program here at CSIS. We're delighted that you could join us for what I think is going to be an extraordinarily interesting program on indigenous politics in the Andean region. We have with us a group of highly accomplished academicians and persons who have been tracking indigenous politics and politics in general in the three countries we're studying for a good bit of time, looking at the region from different points of view that I think will add for a very rich and full discussion. It also comes at a very interesting time with the Bolivian elections approaching this Sunday. That will be a particularly interesting point of reference for not only the Bolivia program, but I think also for the other countries as well, and for the general discussion. So we're going to start today with our panel on Peru. Dr. Cynthia McClintock will introduce the panel. Before going any further, I would like to very much thank the Ford Foundation Andean Region, its office in Santiago, Chile, for its very generous support of this program. And again, would like to welcome all of our visitors who have come from out of town, all of the colleagues from in town, all of the distinguished guests who are coming and will come. And I hope that you have a very enjoyable meeting. Thank you very much. Cynthia.
Thanks so much, Peter. I think it's terrific that Peter DeShazo and CSIS have organized this important conference at this time, and I'm especially glad that Peru was included in the conference. Often in the past, Peru has been contrasted to Ecuador and Bolivia, and the emphasis has been, but why has Peru not had a specifically pro-indigenous movement? But that's obviously changing, and I think ethnic politics have, in fact, always been or for long been important in Peru, and the events in tragic events in Bagua have highlighted that, unfortunately. We have a wonderful spectrum of panelists this morning that Peter has brought together, a real variety of perspectives to bring to the question of ethnic politics in Peru. First, Johanna Christine Birner brings a cross-regional perspective. She has done a great deal of research and writing on Eastern Europe, specifically ethnic politics and electoral politics in Romania, and she brings that to her more current work on Peru. As you can see from her PowerPoint, in contrast to what you see on your form, she is actually an associate professor in the Department of Government and Politics at the University of Maryland. She was there for a year doing research with a fellowship, and before that she was at the University, SUNY Buffalo. And prior to that, she received her PhD from UCLA. And she is the author of the book Ethnicity and Electoral Politics, published in 2007 by Cambridge University Press, and also articles in a spectrum of top journals. Oscar Espinosa brings the perspective from the Amazonian indigenous peoples of Peru. He is an anthropologist who also has a master's degree in sociology from the New School of Social Research in New York. And he is currently not only a professor at the Catholic University in Peru, but also the coordinator of the anthropology program there at the university. And as you can imagine, he was in tremendous demand by the media this summer after the tragic events in Bagua. David Scott Palmer, I think, needs no introduction here. He is, of course, the author of some five books, scores of articles in top journals, And especially important for this panel, he brings the perspective of longstanding experience in Peru's Southern Highlands. He was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ayacucho way back in the 1960s, for those of us who remember this time. He's taught with a Fulbright grant at the University of Huamanga there in Ayacucho. Most recently, he's been leading student groups to study at the university in Ayacucho. And I personally remember very fondly the night now many, many years ago when, as I was just about to head off to do my field work in Peru, he dropped off his dissertation, hot from the press, as I was about to depart one winter night in Cambridge. So, again, it's a fantastic panel, and we'll start with Johanna.
Well, thank you for having me here. This is it's wonderful to be on this panel and meet all of these people whose work I've read over the years. And that's a terrific opportunity to get to speak to all of you. I am a political scientist and mostly interested in electoral politics, and so my few words today are going to be about electoral politics in Peru, sort of upcoming elections, and what some speculation about the upcoming election in the light of what we know about indigenous electoral behavior from the past election. So let me just see how I can get the slides to run. So as I'm sure you all know, the estimates of the indigenous population in Peru vary greatly. We have a number of estimates from census data ranging from figures that tell us that the population is about 19% in 1993, and then later estimates that tell us that the population is significantly larger, sort of depending on how indigenous identity is measured, whether it's maternal language or cultural traits and so forth. But I think it's all of the estimates show us at least that this is a significantly large population, and so it's a population that needs to be taken into consideration in electoral politics. We also know that there's a significant urban-rural dimension. Most of the indigenous live in the countryside, and there's a significant economic overlap, class overlap also with this population. And finally, we know, as Cynthia mentioned, that historically this identity, indigenous identity in Peru, has been weakly politicized. There's been a significant stigma associated with the term Indio, and people are sort of reluctant or have historically been reluctant to identify as such. And as I said, while there are divergent opinions about the precise size of this group, everybody agrees that this is a large group and that needs to be taken into consideration when we're thinking about electoral politics, and I think that the last presidential election was a very good example of that. As we know, Alan Garcia Perez won the election, but a second runner-up was Humala, who, according to all accounts, got a large proportion, if not most, of the indigenous vote. Humala, of course, was a former army man who used nationalist and very neoliberal rhetoric to sort of gain the following of this particular constituency. Peruvian scholars have done some analysis of these elections to confirm common wisdom it was actually the indigenous that voted in large numbers for Humala. In particular, David Sulmont at the Universidad Católica in Lima used 2006 census data to examine the provincial level vote for Humala and Flores and Garcia, and did indeed find that regionally, the concentration of the indigenous was highly correlated with the amount of votes that Humala did get. There was also, as he found, a significant economic overlap. We would have expected this, and this has been confirmed in the data, that when we look at percentage of salaried employees, the number of salaried employees is negatively related to the amount of vote that Humala got on a regional in each region. And according to Sulmont, or his interpretation of this is that is that the share of salaried employees measures the penetration of modern capitalist enterprise in the local labor market. And this has indeed been one of the unifying concerns of the indigenous constituency, that neoliberal policies have hurt this group of people, and that seems to be borne out in the data. It's also important to note, as Sulmont mentions in his analysis, that the overall figure for salaried employees in Peru has declined substantially from the 80s, when it was about 46% of the working population, to about 38% in as measured in 2006. And so neoliberal reform and the economic crises in the 80s have indeed, according to these figures, hurt this population. So why am I interested in the previous elections? Well, I'm hoping that those results can teach us something about the upcoming elections, and the stakes in the upcoming elections are quite significant. In November 2010, Peru is going to hold local elections where 2,000 municipal mayors and 25 regional representatives will be elected. And then, of course, in 2011, we have elections for 130 members of Congress and the presidency. So the upcoming stakes are quite significant, and they're approaching quite rapidly. That brings me to the current contenders for the indigenous vote. According to my Peruvian colleagues who study indigenous affairs, in particular Ramon Pajuelo at the Centro Bartolomé de Casas in Cusco and the Instituto de Estudios Peruanos in Lima, there are three principal contenders for the indigenous vote in the upcoming elections. And these are Miguel Palacín, Alberto Pisango, and Marco Arana. And let me first say a few words about Palacín and Pisango, and then I'll return to Marco Arana. Palacín and Pisango are at the forefront of a new political formation called Perú Plurinacional that has as its overall objective, according to Pajuelo, the reformation of the Peruvian state into a multinational state with substantial recognition of the indigenous. Now, this is very vague, and that's something that I will return to later. It's a very vague statement of policy direction. Now, the grassroots of this party are the various indigenous and peasant organizations, most importantly, the Confederación Nacional Campesinas Afectadas por la Minería, the Confederation of Peasants Affected by the Mining Industry. That was an organization that was created about 10 years ago and that has established quite a bit of presence in defending peasant rights against mining companies using arguments focusing on environmental impact and indigenous cultural rights. And this organization and La Coordinadora Andina de Organizaciones Indígenas, another grassroots organization established in Peru but with a sort of Pan-American reach, are the core of this new party. And Palacín, this the first picture, has been directly involved with the foundation and directorship of both organizations, and as such merged as a natural leader for this new political party, Perú Plurinacional. That party or movement was started only in 2006 and continued to organize in a summit of local organizations that was held in Lima in 2008. And in the following months, there were a number of regional summits where sort of the ideological position of the party was honed. And then in 2009, in June, the party, or the Coordinadora Andina de Organizaciones Indígenas, the Pan-American organization, along with CONACAMI, held a summit at the end of May in Puno, where the platform of the party was continued to be discussed. It was a very interesting summit. I attended it. And as you see, the picture there is kind of hazy. The summit very much tried to sort of incorporate indigenous cultural traditions and so forth, and one of them was burning a lot of incense, and this was the second day of the summit, and by the time we got to the second day, it was quite smoky. But it was a very interesting summit, and a lot of issues were being discussed. Now, during this meeting and after, Konakami made a concerted effort to appeal to other indigenous leaders and organizations, particularly from the Amazon. And as a result of this effort, we saw the emergence of the second serious contender for the leadership of the party, Alberto Pisango. And this is where things get interesting, because just a week after the Puno summit, where I was being told that the leadership of the party was quite contested, the riot in Bagua broke out. And as a consequence of this riot, Pisango accused the Peruvian government of committing genocide, and a warrant for his arrest was issued, and he subsequently fled the country and went to Nicaragua, where he was granted asylum. Now, in October, Palacin announced that Pisango might be chosen as the presidential candidate of Peru Plurinacional. Now, Pisango himself has questioned this possibility, has so far left it open. So at what we have now is this new formation with currently contested leadership. But Peru Plurinacional is competing with another political formation for the indigenous vote, and this is a formation called Tierra y Libertad. And this is not an indigenous movement per se, but it's rather a political movement that aims to present a social alternative to the neoliberal model of governance. And the leader of this movement is Marco Arana, a Protestant priest, who, after successful mobilization against industries, mining industries in Cajamarca, began in 2008 to travel around the country and try to figure out whether this was a sustainable organization. Now, the issues that are presented in particular by Peru Plurinacional, and to a lesser extent also by Arana's organization, focus on the detrimental effects of neoliberalism, indigenous rights, land rights, and mining. And then coca. Coca is a really significant issue with Peru Plurinacional, but not so much with the Arana's organization. I'm just going to very quickly go through sort of some speculation about the electoral trajectory based on what we know from previous election and what we know about these two organizations. Now, the advantages of these two organizations in the upcoming elections are obvious. The indigenous population is very large. There's this Pan-American global restitution of ethnic identity that's occurring and that is aiding both of these organizations. And these constituencies have some real unifying issues: economy, rights, environment. And the Peruvian state has also been doing better in issuing the identity cards necessary for this population to participate in the electoral politics. The problems or the drawbacks are, of course, that there is no unified party representing this constituency. Rather, we have competition within Peru Plurinacional that's not certain how it's going to end, and Marco Arana's organization as well is a real contender. Peru Plurinacional has had some administrative problems also. They've had a difficulty in collection of signatures, in part because their policy program is quite vague. These are recent formations with very little infrastructure other than sort of the grassroots organizations. And their rhetoric in the context of Peruvian politics, particularly that of Peru Plurinacional, is quite radical. And according to the analysis that David Sulmont and others have done, this is a real problem, because the median Peruvian voter tends to be quite moderate. And, in fact, according to this analysis, the reason, the very reason Alan Garcia won the last election was because he presented a more moderate alternative than either one of the other presidential contenders, according to this research. And this is research that David Sulmont has done on previous elections as well, the election of Toledo, for example, and he argues that whoever represents the most moderate candidate wins the presidential election. So what does that mean for the upcoming elections? It means that it's very unlikely that Pedro Plurinacional will be a serious contender for the presidency unless they modify their rhetoric significantly. But if they modify their rhetoric significantly, they're likely going to lose some of their core constituency. However, Marco Arana and his organization are probably a stronger contender for the presidency, but similarly, they'd have to appeal to a larger segment of society than I currently does. The probability of success in local elections is significantly higher, in my opinion. But probably more in the longer term than in the short term. These organizations have, like I said, very little. Or very underdeveloped infrastructures, and so it's very difficult for them to get people actually out to vote, and they don't have very strong policy programs yet that everyone understands. And so it's likely that they may have, if they're able to register for the local elections, they may have some success, but it's likely that the success will be greater in the following local elections. And I think that with that, I'm running out of time. I've been trying to talk very fast.
Well, we appreciate that, Johanna, and we certainly appreciate a preview of the important upcoming election. So thanks very much, and now
sure.
I'll turn to Oscar.
I'm going to speak in Spanish because if not, I won't be able to make it in time. Mi presentación tiene cuatro partes. Efectivamente, como mencionó Cynthia McClintock al principio, yo trabajo sobre todo en la Amazonía peruana, en la región amazónica, y de hecho ha sido el movimiento amazónico, el movimiento indígena en el Perú, principalmente en las últimas décadas. Entonces voy a referirme principalmente a los sucesos que han ocurrido en los años 2008-2009, que terminan con lo que conocemos que ocurrió en Bagua, y luego ver qué ha pasado después de Bagua en la relación entre el movimiento indígena y el Estado en estos últimos meses, el 2009, y las perspectivas a futuro, un poco también enlazando con la presentación de Johanna, porque el próximo año es un año electoral. Y hablaré también algo sobre la relación andinos y amazónicos en esa parte. En realidad, el año 2008, el paro que empezó en agosto del 2008, es el resultado de una serie de movilizaciones que empezaron como un año antes. Sí, el 2008 hubo prácticamente una protesta mensual en distintos lugares de la Amazonía. Sin embargo, es la movilización de agosto la que se convierte en la atención, trae la atención de los medios de comunicación, de tal manera que se convierte en un gran evento mediático y da a conocer por primera vez en el Perú, para mucha gente, este movimiento que es bastante antiguo. ¿Por qué protestan los indígenas? La protesta inmediata se debía a un paquete de decretos legislativos que había dado el gobierno y que afectaban de manera directa derechos indígenas sobre la tierra, pero en realidad la protesta iba más allá de los decretos legislativos y corresponden a la sensación de parte de las comunidades amazónicas, comunidades indígenas amazónicas, de una invasión agresiva de sus tierras en los últimos años. Son políticas en realidad que han comenzado hace dos gobiernos, durante el final del gobierno de Fujimori, y se han ido acelerando de tal manera que en el actual gobierno el número de concesiones para empresas de hidrocarburos y para empresas forestales principalmente han sido muy fuertes. La sensación de la gente es de extrañeza, de no saber por qué el gobierno, por qué el Estado está contra ellos, ¿no? Y esto se va a hacer más fuerte después de lo de Bagua. Entonces, el éxito, digamos, de la protesta fue, por un lado, su impacto mediático y la derogación de dos de los decretos. El acuerdo en septiembre del año 2008 era que el Congreso iba a nombrar una comisión especial para evaluar los decretos. Esta comisión se creó, dio su informe efectivamente diciendo que eran decretos inconstitucionales. Sin embargo, hacia el mes de febrero todavía el Congreso no derogaba los decretos ni tampoco el Ejecutivo. Las organizaciones indígenas hicieron llegar sus cartas buscando un diálogo y una respuesta de parte del Ejecutivo y de parte del Congreso. No tuvieron respuesta y empezó el paro nuevamente el abril del 2009. Este paro del 2009 es el que termina en Bagua el 5 de junio. Parece ser, esta semana ha salido la noticia de un acta de los organizadores del paro unos días antes, dos días antes de la matanza de Bagua, señalando que iban a retirarse porque el Congreso ya había decretado una moratoria de la aplicación de los decretos. Sin embargo, se da la orden de desalojar la carretera violentamente por la policía y, bueno, vienen los sucesos que ya conocemos. Entonces, en realidad, la protesta indígena va más allá de los decretos y, en general, hay una situación bastante grave de parte en este momento porque el actual gobierno, el gobierno del presidente García, el gobierno del partido aprista, no se ha caracterizado precisamente por sus políticas indígenas. En realidad, no tiene políticas para los pueblos indígenas e incluso diríamos tiene políticas anti-indígenas. Por ejemplo, el INDEPA, que es la Oficina del Estado para los Asuntos Indígenas, fue desactivada poco tiempo después de asumir el gobierno el presidente García. Ante la presión internacional fue vuelta a crear, pero ya no como un organismo autónomo, sino como una oficina solamente para ejecutar políticas del Ministerio de la Mujer y del Desarrollo Social. Cada una de estas reorganizaciones, digamos, disoluciones y reorganización, supone varios meses de inactividad. Y evidentemente durante los paros del 2008 y del 2009 fue evidente para todos que el INDEPA no tenía ninguna voz ni voto ni ninguna actuación importante. Después del 5 de junio, la nueva ministra declaró en reorganización el INDEPA. Eso fue en junio, estamos en noviembre, sigue en reorganización, en diciembre, no sabemos todavía cuándo va a terminar esta reorganización. Entonces, de alguna manera, es una muestra del poco interés del Estado de tener políticas claras para los pueblos indígenas. Igual ocurrió con la educación bilingüe. La Oficina de Educación Bilingüe Intercultural fue pasada de una oficina autónoma a una oficina dependiente de la Oficina de Educación Rural en el Ministerio de Educación. Y han habido también nuevas normas para la contratación de maestros, lo cual tienen que dar un examen y no se toma en consideración el carácter bilingüe de los maestros, ¿no?, en la Amazonía, de tal manera que el año 2009 solamente 4 profesores bilingües pudieron aprobar el examen, que fue preparado pensando en maestros castellano hablantes. Finalmente, tenemos, digamos, los sucesos de Bagua llevaron a la creación de una mesa de diálogo que ha sido llamada Grupo Nacional de Coordinación para el Desarrollo de los Pueblos Amazónicos. Esta mesa de diálogo, en realidad son 4 mesas, fueron creadas el 10 de junio, pocos días después de Bagua, con representantes del Estado, del Poder Ejecutivo, de los presidentes de los gobiernos regionales de las regiones amazónicas y por representantes indígenas, además de representantes de organizaciones de la sociedad civil. Las 4 mesas tenían como función, la primera, una comisión investigadora sobre los sucesos de Bagua; la segunda, revisar los decretos legislativos cuestionados; la tercera, ver los procedimientos de consulta para los pueblos indígenas en concordancia con el convenio 169 de la OIT, y el cuarto, hacer propuestas para el desarrollo, propuestas más integrales de desarrollo para los pueblos amazónicos. La primera comisión es la que más dificultades ha tenido para trabajar, y el apoyo del gobierno evidentemente ha sido muy poco para lograr su objetivo de descubrir, digamos, la verdad de los hechos de lo que ocurrió en Bagua. Las otras 3 comisiones sí han trabajado regularmente, con poca participación del Estado y con un abandono paulatino de los representantes de los gobiernos regionales. Sin embargo, la Comisión 2 entregó su informe en el mes de julio-agosto. La Comisión 3, ahora el 23 de noviembre, entregaron su informe final, y la Mesa 4 entrega su informe a fines de diciembre. Entonces están esperando, digamos, ver qué ocurre. La sensación general de las organizaciones indígenas es que el Estado no tiene ningún interés real en implementar ni apoyar esta iniciativa de diálogo. Incluso llegó un momento en el que las organizaciones indígenas quisieron salir del diálogo, y hubo una reunión la semana pasada en la comunidad de Uracusa, en la zona precisamente del territorio Aguajún, que fue, digamos, el territorio donde se produjeron los hechos de Bagua, donde hubo representantes de distintas organizaciones indígenas del país, amazónicas, y se acordó, a pesar de la propuesta de un sector de no continuar con el diálogo, la asamblea decidió continuar con el diálogo, pero la sensación es de apostar por el diálogo para que la prensa no continúe alimentando esta visión de que los indígenas se oponen al diálogo, son salvajes, solamente quieren la violencia. Pero la sensación general es que en realidad al Estado no le interesa los resultados de estas mesas de diálogo. Finalmente, lo que hemos tenido en estos meses ha sido de parte del gobierno una persecución directa contra los dirigentes indígenas y sus organizaciones. Primero trató de desprestigiar a los distintos líderes, por supuesto están perseguidos con orden de captura, acusados de genocidio, Pisango entre otros. Luego intentaron crear una versión paralela, una falsa AIDCEP, que incluso fue juramentada por INDEPA. Evidentemente la farsa se hizo obvia y no pudieron continuar. Y en las últimas semanas el Poder Judicial ha tratado de quitarle la legitimidad a AIDCEP, disolverla, no reconocerla legalmente. Tampoco ha podido, y lo último es que este día 5 de diciembre el Partido Aprista va a tener una reunión para crear su propia organización indígena auténtica, ¿no? Según la invitación, señala que van a ir en contra de los falsos representantes de los pueblos indígenas. Bien, la perspectiva entonces inmediata es, en mi opinión, una acumulación de tensiones que puede llevar nuevamente a otra gran movilización el próximo año. La gente, las organizaciones indígenas y las comunidades están apostando por el diálogo, pero va a depender también la respuesta del gobierno en los próximos meses para que esto no termine en otra movilización o en otros actos de violencia. No solamente está el caso, digamos, de los resultados de la mesa, sino que han habido en los últimos meses otros focos de tensión. Hay un problema con las dos reservas indígenas, son áreas protegidas nacionales, en realidad más que reservas indígenas, la Reserva Maracaer y Madre de Dios, la Reserva Machés en Loreto, en conflicto con empresas de hidrocarburos. Hay un proyecto grande de hidroeléctrica en la Selva Central, y tampoco se vienen cumpliendo los acuerdos de Doriza, que fueron unos acuerdos que se tuvieron en el río Corrientes entre el Estado, la empresa petrolera y las comunidades indígenas para todo el tema de la contaminación de ese río. Entonces hay una acumulación, además, digamos, de los efectos mismos de Bagua, que pueden terminar en otra movilización. Claro, es un año electoral, y para los indígenas amazónicos siempre el interés central está en las elecciones locales y regionales. Hay muchos alcaldes en los distritos de mayoría indígena, hay alcaldes indígenas, tanto a nivel distrital como provincial. En el año 2006 fueron elegidos 14 alcaldes distritales y 3 alcaldes provinciales. Hay algunos representantes también a los gobiernos regionales, entonces ahí es donde se juega para ellos el interés principal. Sin embargo, como mencionaba Johanna, hay por primera vez un deseo fuerte de tener un candidato indígena a la presidencia de la República y negociar también la forma de tener representantes indígenas en el Congreso, ya sea a través de la elección de sus propios en las elecciones generales o de buscar mecanismos parecidos al de Colombia. Y hay en parte de las mesas de diálogo están haciendo esa propuesta de tener también directamente representantes indígenas en el Congreso. Entonces, bueno, Pisango es uno de los candidatos, sin embargo, Pisango también tiene muchos detractores. Entre las comunidades indígenas, y hay otros candidatos que se empiezan a mencionar. Uno de ellos es Miguel Hilario. Miguel Hilario es un dirigente shipibo que está vinculado al presidente Toledo, ha estudiado en Stanford, en Oxford, tiene una trayectoria académica muy interesante. Fue invitado por el presidente Toledo y por la primera dama Elian Karp para dirigir CONAPA, que es el antecesor de INDEPA, como Oficina de Pueblos Indígenas en el Perú, y fue su director un par de años. La diferencia entre Miguel Hilario y Pisango es que Miguel Hilario no tiene una retórica radical. Es decir, los shipibo tienden a tener los líderes shipibo tienden a tener una retórica más dialogante, más de negociación, mientras que los dirigentes generalmente que vienen, digamos, de una tradición en Aidecep, sobre todo de la selva norte peruana, tienen un discurso más radical. Entonces, hay ahí las posibilidades reales, efectivamente, de tener un candidato indígena van a ser menores. Sin embargo, el voto sí va a ser masivo para cualquier candidato que no represente las posiciones oficiales ni del gobierno, ni de lo que la gente, los indígenas, consideran la posición de Lima, ¿no? Entonces va a ser un voto, una elección nuevamente, yo creo la del 2011, de Lima contra las zonas rurales, las zonas andinas y amazónicas. Y en ese sentido, el tema socioambiental, el tema de las empresas mineras y hidrocarburos, como mencionaba Johanna con Akami, ha sido lo que ha unido finalmente al movimiento indígena andino y al amazónico, ¿no? La experiencia de Miguel Palacín empezó bajo la asesoría, digamos, es decir, bajo el apoyo de Aidecep, ¿no es cierto?, cuando se creó primero COPIP y después CONACAMI. Entonces, él, digamos, su historia también como líder está muy asociada al movimiento amazónico, y eso es lo que le ha permitido, digamos, tener experiencia para transferirla al caso andino. Bien, en todo caso, lo dejo aquí para después tener preguntas.
Thanks very much, Oscar. I think there's been a lot of attention here in the United States to the specific events of Bagua, but I think this helped us to understand tremendously both the prelude and the continuing tensions and then the forecast for the upcoming election. So thanks very much, and now I'll turn to Scott.
Well, I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here today, especially in the context of what is a new phenomenon as far as exploring the indigenous organizations of Peru. If we were having this gathering 5 or 6 years ago, the key question, as Carlos Ivan de Gregori and others have put it, would be, why isn't there a mobilization of indigenous in Peru comparable to what we have seen in Bolivia and in Ecuador? And certainly that dynamic is in the process of change. I think it's important, however, to explore, perhaps stand back a little bit from the details of the current dynamic in Peru and the projections to the future, and try to identify and explain, perhaps, how it is that Peru appears to be quite different from the other cases that we're exploring this morning. And those who will be looking at Ecuador and Bolivia will have their own perspective on this, perhaps. But perhaps I can begin the comparative analysis by focusing on what I think is still a valid question, which is the lack of a history of an organized national indigenous movement in Peru in comparison with Bolivia and Ecuador. Now, one of the issues here, which is very important and which we should make explicit and has been intimated by both of my colleagues on the panel today and by Cynthia, is that the definition of indigenous has changed. It is a definition that now includes, as Deborah Yashar has pointed out for Guatemala and others for other cases, it's one that permits a more anthropologically appropriate approach to indigenous activism by self-definition, by those who consider themselves to be indigenous. It's not the old definition that you must speak an Indian language, you must work in Indian occupation, and you must have Indian clothing, which is the old, now outmoded definition. So many things have changed so that people more aware of their background, more aware of their heritage, more educated and in a position to act upon that new awareness are beginning to organize in Peru as they have in other parts of the Andes before. But what are the elements of an explanation for this historical distinction that we, I think, appropriately make between Peru and the other Andean countries? There's the historical cultural explanation, first of all. A very large number of distinctive indigenous groups pre-Spanish conquest engaged in almost constant fighting with obstreperous losers, uprooted and placed among more pacified and submissive locations, a practice continued by the Spanish. The result is high levels of conflict rather than cooperation among and within the indigenous population, along with continuous competition for access to and acceptance by central government authority. Secondly, there's a geographical explanation. The concentration of the indigenous population in the highlands and the jungle, along with forbidding physical barriers between intermontane valleys or plains, as well as between highlands and jungle. Secondly, also a scarcity of arable land. So indigenous have needed to concentrate their energies on producing enough food to survive. Thirdly, the socio-cultural, socio-economic and political explanations, which there are at least two or three, if not others. But first of all, as we all know from our years trekking about Peru, improved communications and dramatically increased access to education from the 1960s forward has produced massive migration from the highlands to the coast, with the more enterprising tending to make up a disproportionate share of the migrants, thereby depriving the Sierra of its potential leaders. And secondly, unlike, it's very obvious, but unlike Ecuador and Bolivia, Peru's capital is on the coast. So that you have two-thirds to three-quarters of government and of economic activity located there in a historically highly centralized system, so fewer economic ripple effects across the Sierra or Selva, and concentration of both opportunities and access far from indigenous population concentrations, which guarantees continuing dominance of the non-indigenous political and economic elites. And the third element within these socioeconomic and political is a very important one, at least as far as the Sierra goes and parts of the Selva. The rise of Shining Path in the 1980s brought forth both a repressive response from the center that can only be characterized as racist, as well as Shining Path's equally repressive approach to forging a collective Sierra peasant movement that tried to impose an ideologically derived structure based on class rather than ethnicity. The result of the actions of both Shining Path and the military included the destruction of much of the fabric of highland indigenous society, as well as the discrediting of any pan-Peruvian indigenous movement for some time to come. Finally, some three or four contemporary considerations that are both reinforcing of these patterns but also countervailing. The first, as has been referred to by my colleagues, is decentralization, including the transfer of resources to elected district and provincial governments that was begun in the early 1990s, and the more recent, 2003-2004, establishment of regional elected governments, with devolution of both authority and budgets. These together enhance the incentives of indigenous groups and others to keep their focus local rather than to join forces at the national level. Such decentralization initiatives have produced literally hundreds of district-level political groups, including, as we've noted, indigenous groups, seeking local elected office, only, in my judgment, reinforcing organized indigenous fragmentation. The second contemporary consideration, as has been in all of our minds these last since the 2006 elections, is the Ollanta Humala PNP phenomenon that burst onto the political scene in the 2006 elections with a runoff that in which the entire, no exceptions, the entire Sierra and part of the Selva voted overwhelmingly for Ollanta Humala. This demonstrated the Sierra electorate's frustration over central government's failure to address its needs. It has the potential to galvanize an alliance between indigenous and other so-called outsiders. However, the factors already noted that militate against such a national movement, plus the somewhat erratic behavior of Humala and the PNP disorganization, raise questions about this possibility, opening up options, as has been noted, for other potential candidates. Thirdly, in terms of contemporary developments, the events in Bagua in early June, led by EDESEP and its indigenous leader, Alberto Pisango, are dramatic demonstrations of indigenous organizing capacity that also included non-indigenous elements. They also indicate as well links between EDESEP, the indigenous organization, and the Partido Nacionalista Peruano, some of whose elected representatives facilitated Pisango's escape after the outburst of violence and his entry into the Nicaraguan embassy in Lima to seek asylum. Finally, central government authorities, as I think Oscar pointed out so well, bear much of the responsibility for failing to address the expressed needs and demands of the Sierra and Selva, in spite of the second Garcia's government's off-stated intention to do so. The Bagua events are only the most dramatic demonstration of this failure. Here, as in many of the large and growing number of social conflicts, as identified by the Ombudsman's Office, close to 300, or at least approaching 300 as we speak, more than double what it was a year and a half ago. Central government shows a remarkably consistent unwillingness to anticipate problems or to dialogue and negotiate until events force them to do so. The continuation of such a mindset at the political center raises the likely possibility of contributing to a growing regional and perhaps even national alliance between Sierra and Selva indigenous organizations and groups, while history and some contemporary elements weigh against this development, it's certainly a viable and even growing possibility. Thank you.
Many thanks, Scott. We've had three terrific presentations, and we now have almost half an hour for questions and answers. And I hope you'll identify yourself, give your affiliation, name an affiliation. Also, of course, try to keep the question, you know, reasonably brief because another time limitations. I would like to begin with a question. I think for all the reasons that Scott and Johanna pointed out, there are have been limitations to what a purely indigenous movement has been able to achieve in Peru. And I think it has made through the ethnic politics of mestizo groups who may not see themselves as indigenous but who do feel discriminated against, whether it's because they can't get into a discotheque or whether it's because they can't feel that they are represented at the cabinet level. And I guess I'd like to specifically ask the Toledo government that was committed to the gobierno de todos los sangres, committed to opening up more at the cabinet level. How do you see the achievements and lack thereof of kind of upward mobility for people of color during that administration? And now we can take a group of – why don't we take a couple questions, and then we'll come back to our panelists and then go for another round if we have time.
Raul Madrid of the University of Texas at Austin. So I guess this question is for all three panelists. First, I'd kind of like to get a better sense of what the prospects are that Perú Plurinacional will actually be able to get itself registered as a party, right? Because – I mean, there have been attempts at this in the past. Most of them have failed. This would be significant because it would be the first sort of – while there have been candidates of indigenous descent in the past for presidency, there's never really been a candidate of the indigenous movement. And then second, relatedly, it seems like, well, even if it does get registered, I mean, I guess – I'm a little skeptical of what its prospects are for actually gaining votes. Particularly, it seems like a lot of it would depend on who the candidate is. I mean, I think the lesson that we've learned from elsewhere in the region is that candidates that are too ethnic or too indigenous, that focus too much on in-ethnic appeals, ethno-nationalist appeals, aren't successful in winning votes because a lot of the votes of these people are people who self-identify as mestizo, et cetera, are, represent the vast majority of votes in these societies. And so I think I actually think a candidate who is viewed as not just representing indigenous interests but more broader spectrum of society might have a better chance, such as someone like Miguel Palacín, I would view as having a much better prospects than someone like Alberto Pisango or Miguel Hilario.
Hi, Kevin Healy from the Inter-American Foundation. Wanted to ask, it was interesting that none of the panelists mentioned the effects of Evo Morales' rise to power in Bolivia and the indigenous empowerment that's taken place in this neighboring country, and particularly its impact on southern Peru. And I was wondering if is this something you factor into your analysis of this has been a something that has also propelled this new indigenous awareness and interest in participating in the political system of Peru?
Why don't we turn back to our panelists, and then we can go for another round of questions, you know, afterwards. Would you like to begin, Johanna?
Sure. I'll speak to the registration and the Evo Morales effects a little bit, perhaps, and then leave the other questions to my co-panelists. The registration is going to be a real issue. The idea for Perú Plurinacional was that they were supposed to collect all the signatures in Puno, and in fact there was a signature drive, and that was not accepted. The jurado has been more stringent in sort of recent elections, verifying signatures and so forth, and I don't know what the details are, whether the signatures were the Puno signatures were rejected or not, but I know that there's currently an effort underway to recollect all of the signatures, and that's proving to be a big problem for because of lack of infrastructure of the party as such and their lack of a coherent policy program. So it's not like they can go around and say, well, this is the policy that we're going to promote and, you know, please allow us to use your name for a registration. So it's not clear to me that they're even going to be registering in time. And I think that you, your question about ethnic appeals is right on the money, so to speak. I think that that's, I mean, your own work has shown that, that this in other in neighboring countries that in order to really create sort of a mass appeal, the indigenous parties have to use more of a populist rhetoric and sort of downplay the ethnic component. And I think that's exactly one of the things, certainly in presidential elections, that's going to be an issue for parties like Peru Plurinacional. I think that unless they significantly moderate or popularize their rhetoric, they're not going to appeal to sufficient number of voters to be able to win a national office like the presidency. It's not clear to me that they will necessarily do this either, because that might hamper their efforts at winning local office. And so they're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. They may have to maintain the sort of more radical rhetoric in order to appeal to the local constituency. But then if they do that, then they are not going to win this national office. And Oscar referred to the fact that there might be other leaders that are perceived as more moderate, and I think only then would a party like Peru Plurinacional, only if they were to select a leader like that, only then would they really be a viable contender for the presidency. And I think that this is supported by the research done by people like David Sumont and others in Peru. The majority of Peruvian voters tends to choose for the president whoever is the most moderate of the, or sort of most centrist of whatever candidates there are. Now, the Evo Morales effect, I think, is quite significant, not just because of Evo Morales, but I think that there is this sort of pan-American restitution of indigenous identity. And this is true most obviously prominently in Bolivia. But at this summit in Puno, there were representatives from indigenous organizations from Mexico, Argentina, Ecuador, Bolivia, Chile, Brazil, all the whole continent. So I think that that is absolutely something that plays into the why we are seeing this current mobilization and the force of the current mobilization, as Oscar mentioned, in Peru. So I'll leave it at that.
About the questions in general, the problem is that in Peru, the elections are defined by the votes in Lima. I mean, there's almost a third of the population living in Lima, so all the campaigns finally rest in Lima and what Lima voters are going to decide. And there are other variables there. There's a strong racism in Lima voters. Even during President Toledo's regime, much of the critiques to the Toledo regime were not about his policies, but rather against him being a person with Indian descent. So that's a big issue. And the media. The media also has played against Evo, a strong campaign against Evo. And, for example, like a year ago, there was a journalist in a important TV program who came to me to he was trying to make a profile on Miguel Palacín, like a year ago. And he told me very candidly before the interview that he wanted to bring down any possibility of Miguel Palacín having a campaign in the future. So, I mean, there are people in the media who are going to be strongly against any of these candidates. The influence of Evo is mostly in the southern Andean region, Puno, Arequipa, Cusco. It's very strong, especially in Puno. In the Amazon, it doesn't make any difference at all. But it's an image of if an indigenous president can be elected in another country, maybe we can also have someday, sometime in the future, our own indigenous president. But I think it's still in the hands of the Lima voters what's going to happen.
Well, there's certainly some interesting dynamics going on in Peru, and by all means, Peru is not in isolation, and the developments in Ecuador and developments in Bolivia have a big effect on consciousness raising, on making people aware of their background, their heritage, and possibilities that exist. And I think this to me is the most important dynamic that we're seeing. And I think both Johanna and Oscar have referred to it. And this is a slowly emerging pride of heritage, a recognition that their background is worth something. It's been so long, you know, over the, God knows, 50 years that I've been trying to understand Peru. This has been a constant. This lack of appreciation of indigenous roots, the desprecio that is offered to people of certain sectors who are identified with certain parts of the country and certain traits and characteristics, as witnessed by central government's actions to this day. It's personal, it's historical, it's structural, it's a mindset of the center toward the periphery that in the case of Peru takes on almost virulent strands that are demonstrably racist in nature. And I think what we're seeing coming out from below is this pushing back, beginning to push back. And I think the external environment has a lot to do with the pushing back. So too does the communications revolution that has made possible people who are historically totally isolated to become aware. I think we're going to hear more in terms of Peru plurinacional and its future, or the future of an indigenous candidate. I think Johanna's right on. I think the future of indigenous candidates is at the local level, not the national level. We're already seeing it at the local level. And that's where, and there are not resources there. It's not worth fighting for. These are new avenues for getting access to the system, new avenues for getting some of the benefits that the central system has to offer. This is real. This is real. And you can see the demonstration of that almost any place you go in the Highlands. Sure, there's a lot of siphoning off, there's a lot of corruption that takes place, but there's an awful lot of very positive and good things that happen. I think when we get to the Ecuador panel, I have every expectation that we're going to see some of the challenges in this tension between, do we want an authentic indigenous candidate, or do we want someone who can reach out beyond? And it seems to me, from what I know about Ecuador, that's an issue that those organizations have had to face front and center. As far as the Toledo government is concerned, Cynthia's observation, I think Toledo, for all of his defects, one of the things he did do was to open up possibilities for people to come from, who are more than competent, to come out of the woodwork, if you will, to take position, to be visible. And I think it's one of the multiple manifestations that we're seeing of this growing recognition that people not like me also count.
Great. We're now can accept more questions. So again, to mention your name and affiliation. Yeah, I've seen a lot of questions. Now let's start in the back.
Patricia Vasquez, and I'm a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, where I'm looking at social conflicts related to hydrocarbons development in Latin America. And my question is, I think, Oscar, you mentioned the fact that these indigenous movements are built around the opposition to some of these developments, hydrocarbons and mining. And I was wondering if you could tell us if you see a real party structure there developing, or is it just in opposition to? And if so, how do you envision these political parties developing one way or the other? And then a related question is, and I'm going to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here, but some of these concessions, the oil and gas concessions, have been given for 20, 30, 40 years, and they're based on an economic development that the government has planned out. Do you see these movements going against that economic development, and how do you envision that being planned out?
I'm Joseph from India, at present a visiting researcher at the Center for Latin American Studies, Georgetown University. Back in India, I engage in policy analysis and policy intervention with the government of India on indigenous people's issues. And I have two, three brief questions. I was wondering whether you could also highlight a little more on the role of indigenous organizations or indigenous international network, or even the role of the church or civil society groups as far as the indigenous movement is concerned in Peru. Secondly, you spoke about shifting identities of the indigenous peoples. In India, there is a problem of inclusion and exclusion, because as far as the support to the movement is concerned, if more and more groups are included in the indigenous communities, it's acceptable. But if it's from the point of view of sharing of the resources, it creates a lot of problem and conflict. And thirdly, I was also engaged in the assessment of the indigenous people's decade in South Asia. And one of the findings was that the government of India was not serious about implementing some of the legislations which were favorable to the indigenous peoples. However, some other legislations like Land Acquisition Act or Special Economic Zones, and there are a couple of other legislations which were unfavorable to the indigenous peoples, were implemented very seriously. And so I would like your comments on some of these questions that I have raised. Thank you.
Sí, buenos días. Soy José Antonio Lucero de la Universidad de Washington, Seattle. Siguiendo un poco la pregunta del compañero de la India, quisiera saber un poco más sobre el papel de la Iglesia, en particular el caso del padre Marco Arana. Recibió un poco de propaganda gratis cuando el cardenal de Lima, bastante conservador Cipriani, criticó al padre Arana por involucrarse en la política, y eso le ayudó un poco la campaña de Arana. Quisiera saber un poco más sobre el papel que está jugando la Iglesia ahora y también las posibilidades que tiene el padre Arana de entrar en alianzas con Palacín, con Conacami, dado que tienen muchos intereses en común. Solo eso, gracias.
Thank you. Catherine Bliss from CSIS. I just wanted to ask the panelists if they could comment a little bit more on the sort of gender and age dynamics within the movements themselves. You know, the extent, some of you mentioned that definitions of identity were changing, and I wonder the extent to which women and men may define themselves in different ways, what their, you know, demands may be or interests in terms of becoming involved, and also the extent to which age differences may or may not play a role in terms of internal conflicts within the movements themselves.
Since Miriam is right there, maybe we'll let me just quickly. Yeah, sorry, and this will be the last question. Just Miriam, oh. Yeah.
Thank you. Miriam Kornbluth from the National Endowment for Democracy. I think two of the panelists have mentioned that the government has been very inefficient or has not been able to handle adequately the indigenous conflict and the indigenous interest. Could you elaborate a little bit on what would be a proper handling of the issue from the governmental perspective?
Start again with Johanna, or
yeah, I'll sort of cherry pick some of these questions. I think many of them are going to be best answered by my colleague Oscar, particularly the ones that have to do with sort of the social networks and civil society. I'll start with the gender one. One of the things that I found very interesting in this summit in Puno was that gender issues were quite prominent in the discourse. There was a lot of talk of women and women's rights and children's rights and things like that. How deep that runs is difficult to say because there's not a comprehensive policy package, and so it's very difficult to assess whether this movement is very committed to gender issues. The assessment of my colleagues when I asked about this that know more about these issues than I was that it was mostly cosmetic, unfortunately. But the encouraging fact is that at least these are issues that are on the table now, and so hopefully in the future they'll be incorporated to a greater extent for real. With respect to Arana, I don't know much about the church ties, his church ties. I know simply that he is a priest, and that sort of was his organization. His sort of original prominence stems from the fact that he was active in his community and that kind of thing. So I'll leave that question for Oscar as well. I'll stop there.
I'm going to switch back again to Spanish to be brief. Okay. Empezando con el género, justamente, bueno, coincido con lo que decía Joana, la semana pasada se acaba de crear una nueva organización que se llama la Organización Nacional de Mujeres Indígenas Andinas y Amazónicas. So they are trying to get together again, andinos y amazónicos. Y está con mucha fuerza el tema de las mujeres. El tema de los jóvenes también, hay muchas organizaciones juveniles. Lo interesante de del movimiento indígena juvenil en la Amazonía es que no solamente ha asumido una línea política, sino también una línea cultural y una utilización de los medios de comunicación, sobre todo internet, Facebook, blogs, con mucha fuerza, con mucha creatividad, y eso ha permitido también ganar mucha simpatía a su causa, porque todos estos jóvenes indígenas que están estudiando en las universidades tejen redes de amistad con otros jóvenes no indígenas o a través de internet, etcétera. Entonces, hay un movimiento fuerte. Por ejemplo, el mes de octubre hemos tenido en Lima una serie de eventos que se llamaba Amo Amazonía, que la idea era de una imagen positiva de la Amazonía no politizada, con mucha actividad artística, pintura, cine, teatro, etcétera, y donde los jóvenes indígenas también han tenido un rol importante. Sobre la Iglesia Católica, la Iglesia Católica durante los años 70 estuvo muy comprometida con las demandas indígenas, y luego entraron como en un cierto retroceso general de la Iglesia Católica, y un silencio que se rompía muy de vez en cuando. Curiosamente, desde el año 2007 hasta el 2009 ha habido por lo menos 5 pronunciamientos públicos de los obispos católicos de la Amazonía peruana apoyando las luchas indígenas. ¿No? Entonces eso es un signo también de apoyo importante, y después de lo de Bagua también la Iglesia Católica ha estado muy fuerte en los mismos sucesos de Bagua, apoyando con asesoría legal, asesoría médica, asesoría apoyo a los indígenas detenidos en las cárceles, etcétera, ¿no? Entonces ha habido un trabajo muy fuerte de la Iglesia Católica en la región amazónica. Evidentemente también las ONGs nacionales, indigenistas nacionales como internacionales, han apoyado muchas de estas actividades. Son financiadas con el apoyo de la cooperación internacional. Pensar, por ejemplo, tener una asamblea de un pueblo indígena que viven pues a distancia, que uno tiene que atravesar ríos durante 7 días para llegar, ¿no?, al otro extremo de la población, bueno, es caro. Entonces, las organizaciones no tienen normalmente el dinero necesario. Sino tienen que contar con el apoyo de organizaciones para poder sustentar muchos de sus gastos. La solidaridad internacional además es importantísima para poder hacer frente a un Estado que históricamente también ha aplastado, digamos, cualquier iniciativa indígena. En este momento, lo que se está, una alternativa que están viendo con mucha fuerza los indígenas con respecto a Bagua y después, es empezar a entablar juicios en el sistema interamericano de derechos humanos contra el Estado por incumplimiento de una serie de puntos del convenio 169 de la OIT. Y en ese sentido coincido, ¿no?, con la pregunta del amigo de la India. Efectivamente, en toda América Latina, durante los años 90, después de la, ¿no?, se han cambiado las constituciones para dar más derechos a los indígenas, y curiosamente en todos los países de América Latina se han recortado los derechos sobre la propiedad de la tierra o del territorio de los indígenas. Entonces ahí hay una política contradictoria que tiene que ver también con un proceso de globalización, de inversión, de falta de recursos energéticos principalmente, que es lo que está haciendo, digamos, la necesidad de explotar más el petróleo. Hay además nuevas tecnologías, de tal manera que pozos petroleros que antes no eran rentables, hoy en día con la nueva tecnología y con la ausencia de petróleo en otras partes del mundo, hace que sea más rentable hacerlo, ¿no? Claro, eso antes de la crisis del año pasado también, ¿no? Ha habido un bajón. Y con eso termino, digamos, con las dos preguntas sobre el Estado, ¿no? En realidad yo no sé si el Estado peruano tiene una política de largo plazo de desarrollo basado en hidrocarburos. Yo creo que lo que hace es los hidrocarburos, las grandes empresas de minas, mineras y de hidrocarburos, lo que hace es dar dinero rápido para el Estado, ¿no es cierto? Es decir, una forma rápida de recolectar impuestos es a través de estas grandes empresas. Entonces ese es, digamos, el gran plan que yo veo, digamos. No hay, digamos, una política de ni energética, ni de control ambiental, ni de ningún tipo, ¿no? Desde la perspectiva de la población, el gran problema no es el desarrollo económico o no, que haya plata o no, que incluso en algunos casos ni siquiera la pregunta es que esté la empresa en su territorio o no, sino la forma en que se da la concesión. No se consulta a la población, no hay ningún control sobre los impactos ambientales, no hay ningún control sobre los gastos de los fondos que recibe los gobiernos vía impuestos a través de estas empresas. Entonces, es más en la forma, y ahí el rol del Estado es fundamental. Si no solamente por no prever, digamos, o sea, todo el mundo sabe los conflictos. Lo de Bagua se podía predecir, ¿no? Y muchos lo han hecho. Sin embargo, el gobierno tiene una actitud, este gobierno en particular, tiene en concreto una actitud de no darle importancia, no darle importancia a las demandas de la población, como decía David, esperar a que ya esté el conflicto abierto para recién resolverlo, y sobre todo es un estilo de menosprecio, de desprecio al indígena, que no lo tendrían si las negociaciones tuvieran que hacerla en otros lugares. Entonces yo creo que hay una mezcla de racismo, de prepotencia, de saber lo que es bueno para el país, sin importar, digamos, tomar en consideración los mecanismos. Muchas veces el problema de los indígenas es no haber sido consultados, no haber sido tratados como personas, sino simplemente que ya uno está en la empresa ahí sin ninguna cosa que decir, ¿no?
Scott, last. Two observations. One related to the hidrocarburos and ambiental issue between local populations and the companies. I participated in a 2 or 3 day conference of journalists, Cajamarca journalists in the area, and the stories they told about the impositions of the companies, the lack of respect, as Oscar has just pointed out, not just government to people, but also companies to people. That was demonstrated, the belief that in their view that many of the companies were simply, they had the concession, they had the rights, and they were going to go forward. While there are exceptions, this is not a universal pattern, the fact that of the roughly 285 social conflicts identified by the Ombudsman's Office this past month or two, well over half, relate to issues of the environment, issues of water, and relate to private companies and local communities, indigenous and otherwise, in various parts of mostly rural Peru. The question about what can government do is fundamental. I think it boils down to that in a very important way. And I think the answer, as Oscar just implied, the answer is one word: respect. I have witnessed the presence of, you know, the plane arrives in response to a conflict with 14 high officials of the Peruvian government. They land in Ayacucho. They come to the municipalidad. They bring in the cocaleros, or whatever group it is that's protesting, whatever they're protesting. They say, oh, we want to sit down. We want to talk to you. We want to really raise these questions and respond to your needs. And they don't bring anybody who speaks Quechua. So somebody has to interpret for them. They say, oh, but we have to be back in Lima by 3 o'clock this afternoon, so here's what we're going to do. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now we have to go. Well, that's not a way to progress. That's a demonstration, as I see it, of a total lack of respect for their own ciudadanos, their own populations. And the continuation of this, whether it was Toledo in practice, whether it was whether it's Garcia now, is something that one really would not think would continue to be the case, given the history of Peru's relationships, at least since the 1980s, with regard to social phenomena that develop outside of the center. It's sort of a lack of willingness to deal with it, a lack of awareness, and then when they do, they deal with it in ways that are totally or often very inappropriate. And how can one overcome that? My impression, even though Fujimori gets a bad rap for lots of good reasons, from what I could see in my own research in the highlands, in the if you will, what I would consider to be the best years of the 1990s, before the authoritarian project got fully implemented in the late 1990s, there were serious efforts to address the needs of local populations with micro development programs that, while organized from the Ministry of the Presidency, had genuine local autonomy. We're efficient, we're merit-based in terms of the people that ran them, and dealt with the local populations in terms of what they wanted, how they would respond, and they had responsibility for implementing them. That I think, has produced a certain legacy of what government is capable of doing in peripheral areas of the country, and a certain nostalgia for why can't other governments do that also. So it can be done. When will it happen? Again? Who knows?
It was sobering but very enlightening presentations. Thanks to all of you.
Why don't we take 5 minutes to stretch our legs and grab another cup of coffee, and we'll start with Ecuador. Thank you.